with the police banging on the door. Open up.
The choice to be in that lineup was the last choice I made as a free man.
A year later, I ended up right in the system.
I'm going to be one of those people who everyone in the world is going to think is a monster or suspect is a monster for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to have to come to peace with that.
Somebody was able to look at my picture in a database and say that I was somewhere where I definitely wasn't.
I overheard three of the jailers discussing what part they might have to play in my hanging. They had been told that two prison officers would have to participate in my execution.
And I walked back inside that prison for the last time, man. All hell broke loose, man.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This weekend, we're recording from sunny San Diego at the Innocence Network Conference. And because we have so many exonerees together, we'll be doing two shorter interviews with two incredible exonerees who will talk about what this conference means to them, Floyd Bledsoe and Cornelius Dupree. But let's start with Maddie DeLone, the executive director of the Innocence Project, who will explain how this conference came into existence and what it's all about. Maddie DeLone. Maddie, welcome.
Thanks, Jason. Great to be here.
Maddie is a force of nature. She has spent her entire life in criminal justice reform, fair to say. And everything from working inside of prisons to really building and running what is the organization at the forefront of the Innocence Movement, epicenter, whatever you want to call it. And we're here today at the Innocence Network Conference in San Diego, which is an out-of-this-world extraordinary event. And Maddie, you and I go back to the beginning of this together, and your memory's better than mine. So I wanted to talk to you about how this all started and also what it means to be here, not only for you and the staff, but for the exonerees.
Wow, that's a lot, Jason. So the Innocence Project started about 25 years ago as a small clinic at Cardozo Law School with Barry and Peter running the show, working with students, other law professors, and really understanding the power of the science to get people out of prison. The DNA technology was pretty new in the criminal justice system. Pretty quickly, they realized how many innocent people there were and how much work it was going to take to get people out of prison across the country. And they began to find law professors really at other universities across the country to do this work. So the sort of next projects in the network were formed. The Innocence Project in 92. There was a project in 94. I just heard that the Innocence Project Northwest celebrated their 20th anniversary this year. So those were among the first projects. And pretty quickly, people realized they needed to have a way to come together and to begin to share what they were learning and figure it out. You have to remember that while we have 50 post-conviction DNA laws right now, so for people for whom DNA can prove innocence, you now have a way to get back into court. That wasn't true when this all started. So they had to figure out, how do you get back into court when there's no mechanism? And they use the press and they use persuasion, and more they could use, as they began exonerating people, the power of those stories and the experiences of the exonerees. I think the first network conference was in 2000. So it's 17 years later, and this is the 16th conference. At that first conference, there were maybe 75 or 80 people. I wasn't there, but Barry and Peter were there, and a number of the people who are still in this work today. And with each conference, the conference grew, new projects started, more people were exonerated, the exonerees began to come to the conferences in bigger and bigger numbers, we began to work, you began to work to help pay for people to get there, to put them up in hotels, people who had no resources.
Right, these are people from all over the country and even other parts of the world as well.
That's right. We had an amazing conference at the Ohio Innocence Project hosted in 2011, I think, where we invited Mark Godsey, who is the Ohio Innocence Project director, really invited people from around the world who were doing this work to come, and they brought exonerees from Japan and Italy and other places. So it has grown from probably in 2000, maybe 8 or 9 exonerated people. And today in San Diego, there are almost 200.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, last night we posted a graphic on the screen with the total number of years served, including 222 years served on death row. And it's so extraordinary being here and being a part of it and just sort of experiencing the energy, the positive energy that's developed, or that's generated, I should say, from the exonerees being around each other. Because not unlike what I understand to be the case with POWs, prisoners of war, no one can understand what they've been through except for each other, as much as we try and as much as we want to help. And so it's really been an extraordinary journey to watch them heal. And it's obviously a very long, it's a never-ending journey, but progress is being made in this building as we speak, and that's a remarkable thing to be a part of.
Can I just tell you a story? I just heard from one of the directors of one of the projects this morning. They had a client who got out of prison after 32 years and got out maybe 4 or 5 months ago, came to the conference last night, as you were saying. There was an introduction of all of the exonerees, including 47 exonerees who had never been here before. And at the end of that presentation, and the whole crowd is standing and cheering and crying, and they're hugging each other on stage, her client walked down the stairs from the stage and said to her, "This is the first time I felt free."
I mean, it's heavy. And it's magical. I mean, there's no other word to explain it. And yeah, it's so great because every time one of them gets up and the crowd erupts, nobody tells anybody to erupt and nobody tells anybody to stand, but it's a standing ovation every time. And they're really among their peers and they're among people who love them and care about them as we do. So it's just an awesome thing. What is that for the Innocence Project? I mean, how have you been able to focus the staff who traditionally were just focused on the legal stuff? How are you able to build this into the sort of the for lack of a better word, the DNA of the Innocence Project?
Well, one thing we had, you know, as we got more and more people out, about 10 years ago, we actually made the decision with our board that you're on to hire a social worker. And we now have 2 social workers who work in the office, and each of them works on cases as people are about to come home and then is a person for them to go to and talk to over the course of, you know, intensively probably the first year, but for some people, they're still talking often 10 years later. We also have developed a fund for Innocence Project exonerees who don't have resources or have family without resources when they come out, so that we can help pay for rent or medical care that's not covered under state insurance schemes or whatever the case may be. And I think we're trying to get, I know we're trying to get better and better at that every year, and we're learning more and more from the exonerees themselves about what it takes. And one of the things I think it takes, and you talked about it at the beginning, is bringing them together with each other more often. They really are the people who are best able to help each other heal, and we're realizing the importance of their families and the importance of helping find support for their family members, because like the exonerees, the family members worked for 12 years, 14 years, 20 years, 30 years, when they stuck with them, they worked to help get somebody out. And if you've been on that course of getting yourself out or helping someone else get out for 20 years and then they're out, you have to find the next course of purpose. And I think there's hope for many people that it will just be glorious and perfect and they'll be free. It's the thing they worked at for so long. But life on the outside is hard.
And the first question people want to know is, do they get compensation when they get out? And they're flabbergasted to find out that not only are there, I think, 20 states that don't have compensation statutes at all, but also, even if you are entitled to compensation, it can take many years to get it. So you're just in the twilight zone now. You're out and trying to figure out how to live with nothing. And it's an incredible series of challenges. Let's just talk for a moment, Maddie, about the strategic litigation aspect of our work.
All right. So we have two programs, and the strategic litigation program is a pretty new program for the last 5 years, although I like to think that the Innocence Project has been doing it in maybe a less focused and concentrated way forever. But the strategic litigation unit, which was founded 5 years ago by your generosity and that of your family, run by Christopher Fabricant, who's a brilliant lawyer, really works on getting the courts to understand their role as a gatekeeper of bad evidence going into cases. And so the Strategic Litigation Unit takes cases around the country where there is bad forensic science that is trying to be introduced, or eyewitness identification procedures that were done in a way that's not reliable and not likely to give you the best ID. In fact, 75% of the DNA cases have had an eyewitness identification, which is erroneous. So we know how important it is to get the ID procedures right. And our team finds cases to teach courts about how to vet evidence and to keep bad evidence out. And if we can keep bad evidence out of these cases in the first place, then you'll never have people being wrongly convicted. And unless and until the police and prosecutors and the courts understand that at the front end and begin to implement procedures and keep the evidence out of court, we're going to continue to replicate the problems we have with wrongful conviction and to put more people in. And you said it yourself, it takes forever to get them out. If somebody goes in and they exhaust their state appeals 8 years later, and then they write to us, and then we take their case, and then we litigate the case for 10 or 12 or 15 years sometimes. Heard someone today who has a case that they picked up in 1999. It's 2017. The person was just freed. That's an entire life. So we have to stop it at the front end, and that's what the Strategic Litigation Unit tries to do. The Joseph Flom Special Counsel has done amazing work in the courts to try to protect people from having bad evidence admitted in the first place in the courts, and that's what it's going to take to really change the system.
Yeah, and I know that my dad, if he were here, would be thrilled to see the quality of the work that's being done in his name. He was a supporter of the Innocence Project, and Skadden, of course, has donated tens of thousands of pro bono hours.
Millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of legal, brilliant legal talent and support to the project.
And they still do to this day. Recently, Keith Allen Harward was freed after 33 years in prison in Virginia with the help of the pro bono department at Skadden in D.C., run by Don Salzman. So yeah, it just continues. Unfortunately, our work will never end. We'd love to put ourselves out of business, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen in our lifetimes. Maddie DeLone, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today, and I really appreciate you stopping by and dropping some knowledge.
Thank you, Jason. Great to be here. Keep up the great work.
So that was a great introduction to the conference from my friend and partner in fighting injustice, Maddie DeLone.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Let's continue with the one and only Floyd Bledsoe.
After spending 16 years behind bars for a murder his brother committed.
In 1999, 14-year-old Camille Arfman went missing after getting off the bus from school. Bledsoe's older brother, Tom, confessed several times to the murder and led police to her body. But several days later, Tom Bledsoe changed his story, pinning the murder on Floyd. New DNA evidence in October of 2015 implicated Tom Bledsoe.
Just over a month ago, Floyd Bledsoe's murder conviction was overturned.
Law enforcement, a district court agreeing he was an innocent man.
Floyd Bledsoe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Floyd is an exoneree from Kansas who served 16 years?
16 years.
And you out there listening had just as much to do with it as he did. That's fair to say. And his attorney, Alice Craig, is here. Alice, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So we're here at the Innocence Network Conference in San Diego. Have you been to San Diego before?
No, this is a very beautiful city.
Yeah, I love it. It's different than Kansas.
Very different than Kansas.
No ocean there.
No ocean?
No. I mean, I just can't even. So your case, in a nutshell, revolved around this rape and murder. And it's so bizarre because this one came with instructions, right? Tragically, your brother was the culprit.
Right.
And what makes this so insane is that he confessed to a religious figure, was a pastor or something.
Yeah.
And then he confessed to the police.
Yes.
And he provided the murder weapon, told them where to find the body.
Took him to the body.
Took him to the body.
Yeah.
Right. So you're probably having the same reaction I was, which was, okay, so thanks for telling us and here's your one-way ticket to prison, right? I mean, but that's not what happened.
No.
Can you walk us through how you ended up being charged for a crime that your brother had not only clearly committed, but had confessed to in every conceivable way?
Right. And he had confessed to multiple times. Multiple people had heard him. Basically, what happened on November 7th at about 10 o'clock that evening, he went to the police station, made a phone call to the pastor of the church, said, "Hey, this is Tom. I'm sorry I lied to you. I know where she is. I'm going to turn myself in." He says, "I wish I could have turned back the hands of time, but I can't." And then he said, "Please help my parents through this." And then he hung up, called our father, and then called Jim back again and left basically the same message saying that he wished he hadn't done it, wish he could turn back the hands of time, but he made his choice. He's going to pay for it for the rest of his life, and that mom and dad were mad at him and he was turning himself in. He asked the church to forgive him, God to forgive him, and they took him to get an attorney. Then the attorney went to the police department. His attorney told him that Tom knows where the girl is, and then the police went with him to where the body was. He showed them. The detectives testified at trial that the area was so well concealed, only the true perpetrator would have known.
Yeah, it wasn't a lucky guess.
No.
No.
And it was the middle of the night, dark.
And he had just bought the gun, and he had just bought the bullets.
I mean, 2 weeks prior, so much stuff.
This was literally the easiest case in the history of criminal justice for the authorities. Alice, would you disagree with that?
No, I wouldn't.
I mean, this was it. Like, I mean, it's gift wrapped.
Right. They charged him with murder that Monday. 3 or 4 days later, he decides he doesn't like jail and says he didn't do it, that his brother did it, which was me. So the police were like, "Well, how did you know all this stuff?" He said, "Well, he confessed to me on the side of the road." Detective Carino says, "Okay, that's plausible." And says, "When?" Tom says, 2:30 in the afternoon. Randy says, "Are you sure?" And this is all said in my trial. Randy says, "Are you sure?" And Tom says, "Yep, I'm positive. Had to be 2:30. Randy admitted in trial that he told Tom that he was lying. And Tom said, "No, I'm not." He goes, "Yeah, you are. You want to know how I know you're lying?" He was like, "How?" He said, "Floyd was sitting in my patrol car at 2:30 in the afternoon." And Tom said, "Well, must have been earlier." Randy admitted to giving Tom facts to make his story more believable at my trial.
The whole thing is just like my there, head.
There's so much. Basically, it come down to people getting tunnel vision, people making mistakes, poor detective work. Stuff that should have been investigated, they didn't look at. And then you throw Tom's defense attorney who, you know, his job is to get his client off any means necessary within the law, supposedly. And so I don't think we know the true reason why everything went the way it did. But ultimately, with his attorneys and help and poor investigation, things flipped. They arrested me. They claim on November 15th, but when they interviewed me on November 11th, I believe it was, 12th, somewhere around in there, they had me in a holding cell, wouldn't let me leave. They told my wife, or my ex-wife, but my wife then, that they didn't know where I was. They said he got in a car and left. When she said, "Well, his car's out front," they told her, "He left. We don't know where he went." I was in their holding cell.
The whole thing is totally surreal.
Right? You know, for 4 days, nobody knew where I was except them. And then finally, after the press got a hold of it, then they charged me with first-degree murder. And then I went to trial. I had poor representation. and got found guilty. The Topeka Capital Journal interviewed an individual who was on the jury member, and he said, "We didn't know who did it, but this was our opportunity to make somebody pay.
Wow.
I guess we made a mistake." 16 years, that's a mistake.
I guess we made a mistake. We just had somebody pay, just pick somebody out of a phone book and just, you know, I mean, in this case, it was just, you know, Alice, what a crazy turn of events. I mean, ultimately, Floyd was exonerated, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And Alice, how did the exoneration come about?
So Floyd's case is one of those cases that I think every lawyer who looked at it was really interested in and wanted to help. None of us were going to let go of it. My clinic at KU Law School, the Innocence Project there, we took his case on. We probably started working on your case in 2005.
Yeah.
And went to federal court. And the interesting thing with the federal habeas that we did is that the federal district judge, when we filed our habeas, actually ruled in Floyd's favor and issued an opinion that essentially said Floyd was innocent and this conviction couldn't stand. Once he did that, Floyd said, "Well, can I be released?" And I guess. So we asked the federal court to release him while the state appealed, and they did. So Floyd was actually out for a year. That was probably
9 months.
That was probably the hardest thing for us. The state appealed his case to the 10th Circuit. I remember when we were about to argue in the 10th Circuit, I was talking to the state's attorney before we walked up to the podium, and he said to me, "We don't think Floyd did it, but we have to protect our jury verdict."
Okay. Wow. Let's just think about that for a second. We
don't
think he did it, but the jury verdict is more important than justice or one person's freedom and liberty and all that, the pursuit of happiness, all that stuff is all out the window because we need to protect our jury verdict because it's so sort of quaint.
Well,
right?
Actually, what gets worse is we lost in the 10th Circuit because of the standard of review. And the 10th Circuit said, "We're not going to overturn the Kansas state courts." And so we lost and they reversed the federal district judge. And I had to call Floyd and tell him he had to go back to prison.
But then you got him out, obviously, because
right.
We're sitting here. So
at that point in time, we filed for DNA testing. And one of our concerns was that the investigation that was originally done, and I think it goes back to what you said at the very beginning, that this seemed to be a slam dunk case. So a lot of investigation that should have been done wasn't done. And our biggest concern, I think, was whether or not there'd be evidence to test. That was the largest concern we had.
And they actually told me over and over again, they were like, "Look, we can't go back and fix bad detective work. You can't." Because we're talking, at that time, it was 12 years?
Yeah.
12 years later. You know, it's not like you can just walk back even a few months and see everything because a lot changes in 12 years.
And by the way, and there's no way to tell this story in as short of a time as we have here because it's too twisted. But on top of everything else, we can't leave out a couple of important details. One is that your dad got involved at the trial. He testified in favor of your brother, saying that he, you know, he gave him an alibi. He created all kinds of phony alibis and stuff like that, which is so, it's like something out of Shakespeare. Right? Or a Greek tragedy. We find out later that he was actually protecting himself because he helped with covering up and disposing of the body and all that stuff. And he didn't want, you know, he didn't want to go to jail.
Well, when we pulled the DNA, that's when we discovered, obviously, one of the motives for him to wanting to cover for Tom so hard.
Right. And the DNA proved conclusively that not only weren't you the culprit, but that in fact the perpetrator, but in fact it was your brother and that your dad's DNA was found on her socks, on the victim's socks, because the theory there is that he helped to drag her, it sounds grotesque, to the gravesite or whatever. And of course, that's a crime as well. In protecting himself, he managed to flip the script and get his innocent son sentenced for murder while his guilty son stayed out. And then to wrap up the crazy, right, as if all this wasn't crazy enough, he killed himself.
He did kill himself.
Right. And he left three suicide notes in which he said, in case anybody wasn't listening the first time, he said it again, that he did it, that you didn't, that he was the, you know, the sole perpetrator.
Right, and that he sent an innocent person to prison.
His own brother, right?
Exactly.
Who's sitting here with me right now. So we hear at the Innocence Network Conference in San Diego, a weekend of healing and hope and strength. And you are a shining example of all of those things. I mean, if you could see and meet Floyd, you know, he's just sort of a, I mean, you'd never know. You know, he looks like a guy who won the damn lottery. You know what I mean? And so that's the way he carries himself, which always, I mean, all respect to you. I'm always amazed at the joy and grace that the exonerees exhibit, and you're as good of an example as anyone could be. So let's talk about how you got from there to here, right? Because you come out of prison, but it ain't so easy after that, is it?
No. You know, when an exoneree comes out of prison, they don't have much, if anything at all. Kansas does not have any compensation laws. I'll speak for Kansas because that's what I know. After 16 years, you make $1.05 a day. And that's only if you work the job. The days you don't work, you don't get paid.
$1.05 a day.
Right.
Okay.
You know, and most...
And let's, one more time, and no compensation laws.
And no compensation.
Right. One of the 20 states that has no
compensation.
And that's
only 5 days for 8 hours. Put that on a credit report.
Right.
You know, how much did your last job pay? $1.05 a day.
5 days a week. Yeah, it sounds a lot like $5.25 a week, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, you made $525 a week? No, not exactly.
And so when we come out, you know, the clothes that you see, you know, when I was coming out of the Jefferson County Courthouse, the flannel shirt, the jeans, and the shoes, that was bought by my attorneys. I had an aunt and an uncle and a few family members. But my aunt and uncle stuck by me for the whole 16 years.
And let's not leave out of this your kids.
Right.
Because when you went in, they became victims too.
I had two boys and a wife. She got divorced because obviously, you know, it was her sister-in-law, or it was her sister. And she had the police and the county attorney was telling her all this stuff, lying to her, you know, lying to the family. She took my kids from me, filed to have my rights removed. The last time I saw my kids prior to my release was November 12th at 1:30 in the afternoon of 1999. I gave Cody, who was 2.5 at that time, and Christian, who was 9 months, a kiss and a hug and said, I'll be back in a couple hours. And I never came back. And then for 16 years, I didn't see him. You know, I wrote letters. You know, I had a nice stack of letters, wrote to him. When I first started, every day I'd write and say, I'm coming home. I'll be home soon. On their birthday, Christmas, everything. You tried not to lose hope. And ultimately, after a while, I gave up writing because I had no place to send the letters. Nobody to read to the boys. To tell them, hey, I love you. I'm thinking of you. I haven't forgot. For 16 years, I never once forgot my kids. I got a lot of friends that are still in prison. Most of them are rightfully there. And I remember once, right before I got released for that short time in 2008, you know, he was like, Floyd, do you ever think you'll ever be able to see your kids? And I said, well, someday I'll be able to see them. Most people were like, you're crazy. You're crazy. You're never going to get out. You keep saying the same thing week after week. And finally, in 2016, in April, I saw my kids.
What was that like?
Well, they're much taller. Cody's almost 6'2", and Christian's 5'11".
Wow, because you're not a tall man.
No, I mean, only 5'2".
They're towering over you.
Yeah, you know.
But I mean, you left them as these little babies,
yeah,
and now you're looking up at them.
Yep. And you know what? There's no two people on this earth that I'd rather look up to than those two boys.
And they're doing good now.
They're doing very good.
In spite of this terrible childhood that they had to endure without their dad, and with this being fed these lies, and believing that their dad was a child rapist and a murderer, right?
Right.
I mean, what a way to grow up that is. So somehow or other, you persevered in prison, even with this added burden of not being able to contact your kids. And you can see, I mean, I'm looking in your eyes right now, and the pain is, it's unreal. And as a parent, and I'm sure a lot of people that are out there listening have kids, I'm sure you can you know, try to imagine what that would be like, but we can't imagine.
Exactly.
And that's what's so powerful about this conference, I believe, is being able to get people together who have had similar experiences.
Right.
And you would know better than
Last year was my first conference in San Antonio. I'd been out 12 weeks.
12 weeks.
And, you know, I show up here and you're just starstruck. Because in Kansas, you feel like you're all alone. But then you get here. Last year, there was 153 exonerees that had been in the same boat. I remember sitting down and eating with Amanda Knox and Ryan Ferguson. And finally, you don't have to explain how you feel because they already know. You don't have to answer all the questions of, well, what do you mean by that? It don't even have to be spoken because we've been through the same or the similar ways. We've all learned how to cope, and you learn how to persevere through it. And there's so much healing, so much renewal here. I've been looking forward to it since when I got back to Kansas City last year. You know, I was looking forward to the next one because you learn that there's people just like you.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's thousands of them. And
yes.
there's tens or hundreds of thousands that are still in. The numbers are truly mind-boggling. Yeah, for me, it's just an honor and a privilege to be here and be amongst you and the, you know, and the other men and women who have so overcome such impossible challenges and odds and tragedies and trauma to be here and be speaking for the people who are still in, really, when you think
exactly.
about it, right? And for each other and standing up for each other like you do.
And that's some of the stuff that I do now is I go to the Kansas legislature and try to get the laws changed to ensure that it doesn't happen. You know, I've spoke on the Mandatory Recording Act for Kansas.
The recording of interrogations?
Right. That's one of the biggest causes was you would think that if you have somebody confessing that you would record it, right?
That would seem smart to me.
Jefferson County did not. They did not do any recordings of Tom until November 24th or 25th.
It just doesn't make any sense
but
whatsoever.
Everybody else, they recorded right off the bat.
It's like Alice in Wonderland. It's just like through the looking glass. It's just
yeah.
backwards and upside down and inside out. Nothing that they did makes any sense.
Right.
And I will say for myself, and I think I'm speaking for 90-some percent of the people that are listening, that if we weren't hearing this from your mouth, the story just, you know, if I tell this story to someone, they're going to go, no, you got something wrong there because it doesn't work like that. It can't work like that. I mean, Alice, you must have the same feeling. Like, it's just totally fucking bizarre.
This case is very bizarre, but it's not the only one. And I think that's the sad truth of it is Floyd and I have been working together for so long, but there's other people that we're going to continue to, as a team, try and get out.
We all have a shared responsibility, and I think everyone who's listening hopefully will feel the same sense
yes.
and want to get involved and help because you can't be around somebody like you, Floyd, and not feel like, Jesus, that could have been me. Because it really could have been any of us,
right?
You're just a regular guy. You weren't some career criminal or some sinister, like, dark force of just a regular guy going about your life with a couple of young kids in the middle of America,
right.
you know? Just a regular guy.
I was working for a dairy. Just trying to raise my kids on the farm.
Right. And then this, right?
Yeah.
And it's just so weird how when the forces of justice, they start to churn and they just grind people up. And it's only a miracle that somebody like you can actually survive this ordeal and come out in one piece with a smile on your face. I see how you light up when you're talking about your kids. So now they're 20 and 18.
Yes.
And they're tall enough to be in basketball players.
Yes.
And they're doing good.
Yes.
So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Brag a little bit. Go ahead.
Cody's just enlisted in the Army. He's going into intelligence. He just finished basic training. He's on his way to go for an extended training for intelligence. Christian is a senior in high school. He'll be graduating in May, going to firefighter school.
Amazing. So you got a soldier and a fireman.
Yep.
And are you close to the kids now?
Yes. I try to get up there at least once a month to see them. Cody will be a little harder because now he's out here, but we stay in contact. Now I do animal portraits, painting and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Floyd learned painting while he was in
prison.
Where
do people see that? You
he's
must have.
Actually exhibiting right now
yes.
at the Johnson County Public Library.
Yes. And it'll be on exhibit till May 15th.
But is there a website people can go if they want to just see it? Because a lot of people can't get to the...
Not yet. You know. I hope to have it up here pretty quick.
Let us know when you do it. We'll put it on our site and people can be able to find the Floyd Bledsoe art. Maybe you'll turn out to be the next, who knows, Homer Winslow or something like that, you know?
And then I got married November 19th of last year.
Congratulations.
Yep. She has a 17-month-old. So I have a stepson that's 17 months, Blake. Wow. And he's a ball.
So it's actually kind of a full circle now, isn't it? Right now you got your kids back. You actually have a young son who's really almost about the same age as one of your kids was when you went in.
Yes.
So it's really a redo, right? I mean, what a difference to see somebody like you who would have been literally rotting and suffering in prison for the rest of your life.
Right.
If not for the fact that good people like Alice and others that donate almost all of their time to the cause had come to the rescue and had ultimately proven that what should have been obvious to the authorities all along, and really was obvious all along.
You know, and I remember just before we filed for the DNA, I would call Alice and Jean and Beth. They give me the answer. We don't know what we're going to do, but we'll figure out something. It was like we hit this big old stone wall. And I wrote in the thank you card to the dean of KU. And I said, when your instructors and your students hit the stone wall, they didn't give up and turn around. They picked up the chisel, they picked up the hammer, and they made a way. And that's exactly what they did. They gave me my life back.
Yeah, they don't make it easy for anyone to get out of prison.
No.
I mean, even with extremely talented attorneys and advocates, which you were, in that sense, lucky to have because a lot of people don't even have that, it's still almost impossible task because they just keep putting up roadblocks. Because like you said, Alice, they want to protect the jury verdict or the wrongful prosecution or the wrongful, whatever the hell it is. And it's so weird. It's like, why? No, this is simple, right? Everybody needs to know who really did it.
It's hard to convince people. Even when we filed the DNA reports in Floyd's case, the investigators for Jefferson County that were reinvestigating it said, well, this doesn't mean Floyd didn't do it or wasn't involved. And it wasn't really until Tom committed suicide that they were convinced. And that was the only thing that did it. If we hadn't had that, we'd probably still be litigating.
It sounds like if you would have had pictures and photographs of the crime taking place and a time-stamped video of you being somewhere else doing something else, they still would have went, well, yeah, they would have come up with it. Because we've seen that. I mean, they come up with theories that are just a first grader would go, that don't make any sense. But they do, and they did, and you're the living proof of it. But now you're here. So San Diego, what are you going to do? Well, now you're saying you're going surfing? What are you going to do out here?
Well,
you're a Kansas guy.
I've always wanted to ride a jet ski, so I'm trying to convince people to ride a jet ski with me. But they're not really hip because they're like, eh, it's kind of cold in the morning. But hey, what's a little hyperthermia? You know, it'll wear off eventually, you know, but.
Oh, well, I'm going to make sure you get on a jet ski if I have to go with you.
So I got the chance to go to La Jolla to see the sea lions.
Uh-huh.
And those are so awesome because you're just a few feet away. You can almost walk right up to them. I wouldn't recommend petting them because they kind of growl at you.
It's
amazing.
Yeah, they don't have those in Kansas either, I guess.
No, they don't.
So I really appreciate you being here. I know it's not easy. I appreciate you being here and also you being here. So I appreciate you being in San Diego at the conference. I appreciate you being a really remarkable beacon of light and hope. And I really appreciate both of you being guests on this very special edition of Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom from the Innocence Network Conference, where we are generating so much positive energy that we could probably light up at least a mid-sized city. Once again, Floyd, Alice, thank you for being here. It's been an extraordinary experience for me. And now let's have some fun.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper
into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Ilya Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's my pleasure, my honor, actually, to introduce a friend of mine for many years, an incredible man, Cornelius Dupree. He maintains and projects an incredible positive attitude and great energy. And that's why he's now an ambassador to the new exonerees, helping them adapt to life on the outside.
In 1980, Cornelius Dupree was sentenced to 75 years for aggravated robbery.
Cornelius Dupree Jr. was just 19 years old when he first went to jail.
The crime included abduction and rape.
He has served the longest prison term of any Texas inmate ever cleared through DNA evidence.
Dupree was released last July on parole after 30 years behind bars. 1 week later, DNA test results proved his innocence.
Cornelius, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
So Cornelius, your story is remarkable in the fact that you served 31 years in prison.
That's correct.
For a crime you had nothing to do with, had no knowledge of, and no involvement with.
That's correct.
And this was a crime, I mean, the length of your sentence is extraordinary and unusual, even among the exonerees, but the causes of your wrongful conviction are common. You were a victim of wrongful identification and, to some extent, racism.
yes. would say, right? And I want to talk about this with wrongful convictions that are based on misidentifications, which is the most common cause of wrongful conviction. It's been proven scientifically that the least accurate form of eyewitness identification is cross-racial.
Yes.
And in this case, and I want to go back to it all those years ago, 1979, right?
That's correct.
That seems like another century. It was another century, actually. And two white people in Dallas, Texas were robbed. It was a couple. And the woman was sexually assaulted by two black men. And you and a buddy were out. What were you doing that night?
We were on our way to a party. They had house parties back then. He and I decided earlier today that we was going to attend this party, a few blocks away from where our parents lived. We lived with our parents at that time. So about maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, we proceeded on to attend the party. And before us, we acknowledged there was a couple of squad cars, you know, just sitting there. So we proceeded on to go to the party. And the cops, they stopped us and asked us where we were going. And we told them we was on our way to the party. And they, at that point, asked us to get up against the car. And they frisked us and found a bag of weed, marijuana, and a little Derringer pistol, which my co-defendant had. So they proceeded to frisk us to try to find more stuff, I assumed. And we really thought, you know, we were in trouble for the marijuana and the little gun, you know, the little pistol and whatnot. So we were thinking that we were going to go to jail and possibly get out. You know, we were probationers. I was kind of borderline, you know, juvenile, young adult, you know. I guess they could have made it a felony, you know, adult felony case.
Because you were 20 at the time, right?
Well, no, I was 19 turning 20, so I was kind of borderline. I think, yeah, I was an adult. Yes, straight across the board, I was an adult. He was a young juvenile.
Right, and to be fair, it was the 70s. Everybody was carrying weed back then.
But, that was the thing.
But the pistol, a couple of young black guys in Texas with a pistol, the cops don't like that.
Yes, that's correct.
And were they white cops?
Yes, they were. They were white cops. They're not coming from an all-black neighborhood.
But you had no idea that this robbery, this sexual assault had taken place, not in the general vicinity.
No, again, I come from an all-black neighborhood, you know, it's all black. And from what I gather, this incident happened a few miles away, which was another neighborhood. I guess at a convenience store or something like that. I'm not really for sure. I mean, I don't know anything about it. All I know is they stopped us, asked us where we were going, and put the cuffs on us, and then proceeded to taking us to the county jail.
And then things went really wrong.
Yes, sir.
You were not a rich guy.
No, right? Sir.
You couldn't afford to hire.
Not by a long shot.
No. Right. So you had a public defender?
Yes, I did.
And the evidence against you, really, they had no physical evidence.
No.
Because if they had, they would have had to lie about that because you weren't there. So the only evidence they had against you was
the marijuana and the pistol.
But that had nothing to do with the crime that you were convicted of.
Well, they used it as, I mean, because I guess the guy was robbed. I mean, I guess that would have took a pistol or something of that sort.
Well, but at the same time, I mean, how many people have pistols? We know there's more guns in America than there are people. And back then in Texas, I imagine a lot of people were carrying guns. That doesn't prove you assaulted and raped or robbed anybody. But there was no physical evidence. There was no biological evidence. There was no blood or sperm or hairs or anything else that could have connected you to this crime, which was, since it was a crime that was physical in nature, that evidence would have existed and would have been able to be tested. There wasn't DNA technology back then, but there was enough blood type or this or that that they could have tested. And if they had, they would have learned that you were not the guys that did it. Again, it comes back to they had circumstantial evidence, which is, here's these two black guys. There's a lot of black guys, though, right?
Yeah.
And here's a little gun, right?
Yes.
And I don't want to minimize that. It was a gun. The weed has nothing to do with anything, right? And then they have these two white people, this couple, who made a mistake. I don't think they wanted to identify the wrong people. I'm sure they wanted to do it right. But we know now, and they knew to an extent then, that eyewitness identification, it's such an imperfect thing. And then, of course, there's all the stuff that happens at the police station and the ways that these procedures are conducted, whether it's mugshots or lineups or any other thing. We know that there've been a lot of improvements since then, and the Innocence Project has been behind a lot of those, but there's a lot still that has to be done to help to diminish the number of wrongful identifications. But in your case, I'm guessing that most of those procedures weren't followed. They had a couple of guys. They probably felt a lot of pressure. This is a crime that, particularly in the South, 1979, a couple white people getting sexually assaulted by a couple black men. They want to get this off their desk, right? There's probably a lot of pressure, probably coming from the top. Get this solved. And they got a couple of guys, and you were one of them. You go to trial. Did you still believe that the system was going to function correctly?
Well, I have to say no in that regard.
As the trial went on, were you becoming more, I mean, obviously you had to be scared, but were you said you were a believer in the system. And a lot of the guys that I've interviewed on the show and women have said, yeah, I thought that justice would be done because this doesn't happen. But in your case, when the jury went out, were you expecting that they would convict you and sentence you to 75 years in prison like they did?
Well, that was like my whole card. It was like, I knew I was innocent. I know nothing about this case in which they were alleging that I committed. And so all I had was the system. So I sit in the county jail awaiting trial so that I can come and sit before the accuser. I really didn't know how the trial system worked. I felt that once I go to trial, I would sit before the accuser and they would actually see me and say, that's the wrong guy. But that's not how it went.
That didn't happen. And then the jury went out and they came back in and then the worst possible result happened.
Yes. Guilty verdict.
Was your family in the courtroom? What was that moment like? How did you even deal with it?
They did not let my family in the courtroom. They stopped him at the back of the court and for whatever reason did not allow them in. I was not allowed to testify due to the public defender that I had. Told me that it would be to my best interest not to take the stand because they were going to make me look like a hoodlum or something like of this sort.
From public menace.
Yeah, and they were saying that the burden of proof was on them to prove that I was guilty, that I didn't have to take the stand and to prove my innocence. And being naive, to the law, I said, well, I'm innocent. And I felt like, okay, I really didn't know. So I sit there, and once I made that decision, they ate my lunch.
So you got convicted, you got sentenced to 75 years in prison, and your co-defendant was sentenced to life. And then so many years went by, and eventually you found out about the Innocence Project. Had you given up hope by this point? Or you were in for decades already by the time that, over two decades.
No, I never given up hope. I always felt that someday I was going to be released. I just didn't know when that day was going to come.
Right, because with a 75-year sentence, they were going to carry you out of there in a box.
Yes, possibility.
That was
yes.
The only way you were getting out. But so you wrote a letter to the Innocence Project in 2007. And obviously, we took your case. And that was the Innocence Project New York. And then things started to really turn your way.
Yes, it was actually after the O.J. Simpson trial. It was a big trial and whatnot. And I think that's somewhere along there, they became kind of well-known, DNA and whatnot. And I was one who was very active in the law library, the writ rooms in the prison system. And one of the guys who knew that I was working on my case and trying to get out told me about DNA. Told me about the Innocence Project and that there was some information that I could use concerning the Innocence Project and DNA. And so I sit in my cell and I had to figure out a way because I know I was in jail for robbery that didn't consist of DNA. I was never charged of the rape case. It was dismissed.
Right.
And so when he told me about the DNA and the Innocence Project, I had to figure out a way in which I could write this letter to the Innocence Project explaining to them that I was in prison for a robbery that I didn't commit. But in the course of this robbery, there was also a rape case that occurred that I was never tried for. They dismissed. And that if you go back and open up that rape case and do a DNA on it, it's going to show that I'm not the perpetrator who raped the lady. And if I didn't rape the lady who was with the guy in which they said I robbed, then I'm not the actual perpetrator.
And that's exactly what happened. Fortunately, the evidence was preserved. It was tested. And you walked out of prison a free man in 2010 after 31 years.
That's correct.
In Texas prisons, which is Even saying that name, Texas prisons, it just conjures up all kinds of nightmare scenarios. I mean, from the heat to the, it's just an unimaginable thing to be able to persevere and overcome. And now you're an ambassador to new exonerees at the conference.
Thank you.
And I want to ask you specifically about the conference, because here you are in sunny San Diego, an ambassador. That really means that you're here to help some of the newly exonerated people. I was going to say men, but we know it's men and women. And what's that like? What does that mean to them? What does that mean to you? Because you're viewed as somebody that is extremely respected among the entire community for the way you carry yourself. How does that feel for you? And what's the impact of that role?
Well, I'm very honored and pleased to have that title, but that's just a title to me. I'm very emotional, and I take it very personal. When I engage with the guys and welcome these guys in as family, what I try to do is give back what was given to me when I was first released, when I came to my first conference. There was a few guys that came up to me after, you know, being confined for such a long time and being all uptight and not knowing what to expect and not knowing anyone. It's very challenging. It can be very scary because you don't know anyone. And being in prison for such a long time, you're in a hard environment. It's a very different environment. It's not an environment in which you embrace people. It's an environment in which you keep people at bay. You know, you keep them away. And so by the guys embracing me after such a long time and welcoming me home and making me feel a part of the family, I took that very personal. That stuck with me. And so throughout the whole time in which I have been free, I was trying to figure out a way in which I can become a part of this platform and give back to these guys and welcome these guys in and allow these guys to know that we are a family and we stand by you and we're going to support you. We're going to do everything we can, me personally, in my power, to make it better for these guys, you know, because we come from different parts of the world in terms of prison, but we all suffer the same thing. And we all can identify with that. And so it's going to take people who understands that to try to make this more of a family atmosphere, more of a welcome home.
It's amazing because I heard you use the word family several times in that beautiful speech. And it really is a family. I mean, that's the sense that I get. And the experience of being in that room last night when almost 200 exonerees got on stage, it was a beautiful thing to see and be a part of. And the speeches that were made and the hugging and the dancing and the connecting of people who have shared this. You know, everybody in that room is a member of a club that nobody wants to belong to. But now it's amazing because every single exoneree I've been privileged to spend time with is so devoted to helping their fellow exonerees and making a difference in not only improving their lives, but in helping other people who are still stuck in the system. And that's what we're here to do on the show, is to educate people and inform people and try to prevent the next Cornelius Dupree from ever happening, you know, ever getting into the system. You know, once you get started on this work, I was lucky, I sort of stumbled into it 20 something years ago. You can't stop, you know, you can't stop because there's no better feeling. And I see it in your eyes when you're talking about it, how you're able to do it now. It's a high that is, it's impossible to even put it into words. So we talked about the worst moment of your life when you were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to spend the rest of your life in prison. What's the best thing that's happened since you've been out?
Being married, getting married to my wife after courting my wife for such a long time. My wife is my best friend. She's my support system. As you know, I met my wife while I was in prison. I've actually known my wife for 20-some years prior to me getting out of prison and marrying my wife. So my wife's been there practically 30 years.
How did you meet her? Let's go back to that.
Well, I met my wife while I was in prison. My wife was actually a prison guard.
Incredible.
Yes. My wife was, she was going to Sam Houston. She majored in criminology. She was on her way to possibly becoming a warden at some point in time. And she was actually a prison guard. I befriended my wife first. She was someone who I highly respected. She had no clue who I was. I had no idea that she would become my wife. Again, she was a lady who I highly respected. My job in prison kind of allowed me to kind of get a little up close and personal with the guards. You know, being that I had been in prison such a long time, I was one who was pretty much trusted. You know, I had a job that allowed me to intermingle with some of the guards. And so she was one who I used to talk to a great deal. My wife is a minister, so she was always talking about Christ. She's very religious oriented, and that's what won me over. That was one of the prayers in which I prayed to God to send me a Christian woman in my life to kind of help me stay the course. I never knew it would be her.
It's an incredible love story. I mean, you can't see through the radio, but Cornelius is a very stylish and handsome, distinguished-looking gentleman. But still, you have to have an incredible amount of game, right, to be able to meet the woman of your dreams while you're on the inside, right? You got tens of millions of people out here on different dating websites can't even find love, and you found it in the most hellish place on earth. It's just really beautiful that you found each other, however, even though it was a horrible circumstance, and that we're able to connect on the outside and create a family. And I see when you're talking about it, I see the love in your eyes. It's amazing. So I would like to ask you if there's anything at all that you want to say.
Well, I would just like to say, to kind of enlighten people about what the Innocent Project is all about. I really want them to know that we are family. I feel that we are now a community. There are so many innocent men and women nowadays that we are actually a community within ourselves. And that's good. That's great, because we can all identify with each other's hurt. There's a big world around us that doesn't quite understand what actual innocence is, what the Innocent Project is all about. And the people who have wrongly been in prison, these people all suffer. We all suffer from some form of PTSD. And we need to be close and identify with one another, talk to one another, so that we can start the healing process. This is what it's all about.
So to add to that, I always like to give people a way to get involved, right? And so, of course, you've heard me say it a number of times, please go to www.innocenceproject.org. You can learn more about Cornelius and his case and his life. You can learn how to get involved. Is there any other website that you'd recommend, or that's the place to go?
Yes, that's the place to go.
That's the place to go. Please join us. Join us in this movement. There's so many more people in this tragic situation, and we gotta give them the hope and give them the ability to get back out on the outside and achieve the freedom that they deserve. Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
month. Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're going to love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.